This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Andy Berry, the host of Metro Morning on CBC Radio 1, 99.1 in Toronto. And this is our weekly podcast, Toronto This Week. It features highlights of our local and regional shows on CBC, shows like Here and Now, Ontario Morning, and Fresh Air. But first, here's an item from Metro Morning. We return now to this week's series, Throw Away Women, where we're exploring the lives of prostitutes in Toronto. Our focus this morning, their families. In Vancouver, it was the friends and families of the missing prostitutes from the Lower East Side who pushed police into action. What's even more remarkable is that so many family members kept insisting police take those cases seriously. This week, some of those family members are hearing the closing arguments in Robert Picton's trial, but some of the murdered women have no one. As Mary Weens tells us, it's just too hard for most family members to stay involved.
Oh, I know. I know how they feel. Like I said, I've made all the phone calls. You know, I've been on the street, you know, during that 6 months when she was missing, looking for her, you know. I've done all that. I've definitely been there.
This morning, Sharon's waiting for her daughter, Tyler, to call. Tyler, at 30, is a prostitute and an addict. After a night on the street or at a friend's house, Sharon's not always sure which, Tyler comes to her place for a shower and to check what's in the fridge. Sharon warns me Tyler may be in rough shape.
She looks very harsh right now. She's been through a lot. That's the other thing, too, with women addicts. I think guilt and shame keeps them where they are, too. And it contributes to keeping them to where they are, you know, especially if they're mothers, you know, and have children.
Tyler is one of those mothers. Her daughter is 9. The little girl lives with her grandmother. Sharon makes sure the mother and daughter don't cross paths.
You know, coming clean as having to deal with all that, to face it without any substances. Again, that must be really hard, too.
Sharon never imagined that her own daughter would turn out like this. Tyler was a confident, normal teenager until a brutal rape at the age of 17. So brutal it almost killed her. After that, says Sharon, Tyler was never the same. It was a boyfriend who introduced her to drugs.
I'm trying to think if I've ever met a woman out there that is a drug addicted or alcohol addicted and is into prostitution that has not been abused. I can't think of one. Maybe there is.
Sharon is a social worker. She spent years working with battered women. As the mother of a prostitute, she's come to know women who go through a different kind of battering, the kind that comes from working the streets.
Hell to get where they are, and they're living hell now. To feed their addicts.
Sharon knows their stories, their sorrows. Sorrow so familiar that even tears don't interrupt the conversation anymore.
You don't even try to hide your tears, though, anymore, eh?
No, I don't. They flow a lot. I mean, I could be driving just down the street, and I can see, you know, a female addict walking down the street, and there's, you know, a vehicle that goes by with 4 young people in it, and they're just screaming, you know, crack, ho, you know, you want this, and I can't imagine being treated like that. I just can't imagine.
The phone rules Sharon's life. This particular morning, she's worried because she hasn't heard from Tyler.
She's probably having a hard time catching a taxi, okay, is what's happened, because I told her just to grab a taxi and come over. A lot of cabs don't want her in the car.
She takes the call, but it's not Tyler. Moments later, the phone rings again.
I don't know what's
going on.
I just feel the need to answer it in case it's her. Hello? Yes, where are you, sweetie?
Relieved to hear from Tyler, Sharon finally relaxes.
Yeah, but how far away are you?
In 15 minutes or so, Tyler will walk through the door.
No, are you in the cab? Okay, hurry up, hon.
Sharon is rare in this world, a mother who still takes her daughter's calls.
Would you hurry up? I'm doing an interview, please. Hurry up, hon.
Still goes looking for her.
She goes, now I'm sweetie. Because I was cross with her a while ago because she was taking so long. Now I'm sweetie, and she's laughing.
Once Tyler went missing for 6 months, Sharon found her at a drop-in center downtown.
She was shocked. I walked in, and she was there, and she was just, she did her first kind of, like she was going to bolt. She didn't want me to see her like that. And then she just kind of fell apart.
In fact, the other prostitutes at the shelter didn't even believe at first she was Tyler's real mother.
They said something. They said, oh, you're street mom. Because I guess when you're out there on the streets, lots of times maybe an older person will kind of take you in under their wing. And so they said, oh, you're street mom. And she said, no, 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 no. This is my mom, my real mom, my bio mom. They were shocked and happy, you know, for her. Yeah, they were like, oh, you're so lucky. You know, I haven't seen my real mom in 10 years, or, you know, I'm not allowed to call my mom, or you're not allowed in that neighborhood. They have a restraining order on me.
And looking at you, I can see why, because that is a burden of pain that you carry, eh?
Yes, it is. It is, but like I said, I don't know how to do it any different.
Sharon's under pressure from the rest of her family to cut her ties.
Your friends, your family see you suffer. You know, they want you just to cut her out of your life. You know, just let her go. You know, there's this whole theory about hitting rock bottom. I can't do that. So, yeah, I guess I live with hope.
On a trip to Vancouver, Sharon made a point of visiting East Hastings, where so many women went missing.
I have goosebumps as I speak. It is a horrible, horrible.
She's haunted by the posters she saw of other family members searching for their daughters, sisters, mothers.
I was prepared to know that there are addicts that openly shoot up on the street because you read all of that. What I was not prepared to see is the bulletins, the posters out there. It's so, you can't prepare yourself for that. And as a family member of an addict, you know, that's me. And to know that young prostitutes, these women, you know, ended up on the pig farm. It's like another planet there. It's like I've never seen anything like that in Toronto.
And Sharon fully understands why some families give up, why they stop taking calls, stop hoping things will change.
I don't fault them. No, I don't fault them at all. I mean, maybe someday I'll get there too. Who knows? Maybe one day you wake up and you can't do it anymore. I don't know. I'll cross that when the time comes.
But for now, every time the phone rings, Sharon grabs it.
I've waited for the phone call. Definitely, I've waited. Definitely, I've had my phone calls to the morgue to see if they have any Jane Doe's there. I've had my phone calls to the hospitals to check on Jane Doe's.
Daughter, a moment later, Tyler walks into the room.
Tyler, this is Mary.
Oh, it's okay. I just talked to your mom.
Sharon's eyes are red from tears. You've been crying, Tyler observes. No, I cry all the time, Sharon says.
I have to meet you, yeah. I actually have to go take care of that.
But this morning, the sun is pouring into the front room of Sharon's apartment in Toronto. Tyler's back home to take a shower, help herself to orange juice from the fridge. For this morning, at least, shining through the tears, Sharon is still hopeful.
The CBC's Mary Weens. Tomorrow on Throwaway Women, we meet the remarkable policewoman behind a new investigative unit, its goal to make the streets safer for the women who work them. Where there is prostitution, there are drugs. And where there are drugs, there's crime. So it's hardly surprising that the worlds of policing and prostitution often intersect. They work similar beats, late at night, often familiar with the same criminals. It's an uneasy relationship ranging from indifference to hostility. In Vancouver, police ignored reports about missing women from the downtown east side for decades. Robert Picton, now on trial for killing six women and charged with many more, is testimony to that uneasy relationship. Closing arguments for his trial are being heard this week. But as Mary Weens discovered in Toronto, one police woman is building a different kind of relationship with prostitutes, and what may be even harder, changing attitudes that prostitutes are throwaway women.
I've got an interview at 2, but I'd like you to move you in the office. Can you want to come in the office? Because Ed and Nathan are there. Sorry, I just got a last-minute interview.
Detective Wendy Lever pauses at the door of the cramped office that houses her investigative team, the Special Victims Unit. She's taped a handmade card to the door. It looks as though it was drawn by a child, with a tree, flowers, a shining sun.
Right there.
The carefully printed message inside tells a very different story.
This is from Tanya, and it's, Dear Wendy, thank you very much for catching the guy who raped us women. It puts our mind at ease knowing he is behind bars and we can get our lives back together. You are the one who has given me strength. Thank you. Respectfully, Tanya, May 16th. If you met Tanya, you would never associate her with the ability to put this lovely little paragraph together. Nathan was there. Remember Nathan?
Oh, yeah.
You only got the card.
First time we met Tanya, yeah? No, never. Never expected her to put something like that together.
To Wendy and the two other officers who share this little space, putting Tanya's rapist behind bars ranks as one of their great achievements. On one wall, the one they call their wall of infamy, are dozens of photos.
These are all arrests that we've done in the course of the unit being set up. And as you can see, the majority of them have been arrested here. And we're just before the courts on most of them. These are the ones that that have been found guilty. And actually, these are Ed's cases. He's probably got a little more insight on these ones.
Congratulations. Why don't you join us? Tell us a little bit about these. I can't imagine that you're fond of too many of them. But
I'm not fond of any of them.
Wendy Lever's investigative team is unusual not just in Canada, but anywhere in the world. Its job, investigating assaults against prostitutes and cracking down on child prostitution, a growing issue internationally. In many ways, this is a new approach to policing.
After drugs and guns, prostitution is actually the third largest crime industry in the world.
People question, why would we use the resources on sex workers? You know, they made that choice. They know exactly what they're doing, and that's part of their job. So what? You get physically or sexually assaulted a couple of times a week. Look at the money you're making. We have basically dehumanized sexual people who work in the sex trade. We marginalize them. So then the Johns, the individuals that sexually assault them, take it for granted they can because society in general doesn't give a damn.
The work requires an unusual set of policing skills, the empathy of a social worker, an investigator's meticulous attention to detail, and the patience of Job. Many prostitutes have no fixed address. By the time they get a court date, the prostitute may have vanished. Add to that enormous mistrust. Few women believe the police are serious about protecting them.
In the mind of the sex worker is that the justice system will provide them no type of comfort, no type of justice. They really believe that. Because it's not really an offense, it's just a sex worker. You deserve what you got. So we're trying to change that attitude. It's very difficult sometimes just approaching the sex workers on the street because we're still cops.
Some figures suggest prostitutes are 4 times more likely to be assaulted than other women, 3 times as likely to be killed, and hardly worth a mention. Wendy Lever says few reporters call when she issues a news release about a sex worker who's been assaulted. She wants those attitudes to change.
I don't think that an assault against a sex worker should be considered an occupational hazard. It's a criminal offense.
It can take months for that offense to lead to a conviction, working with witnesses who aren't used to sticking around for the long haul, and enormous rewards, like the response from Tanya, whose handmade card is taped to Wendy's door.
I get a call from her April the 18th. She says, Wendy, you're looking for me. I said, yeah, I am. She says, I'm clean now, I'm clean. And she was at a hostel. I said, that's wonderful. She says, well, what do you want? And I told her. And she goes, you got him, you got him. I'm so excited, you got him. I said to her, yeah, and Tanya, what we need to do immediately, as soon as possible, I need to do a photo lineup. No problem, I'll be there. And sure enough, the next morning, next afternoon, we show up at the hostel, and there she is. Gives us a big hug. And here she is, a drug-addicted woman on the street. If you take a look at her, nobody gives a damn. Yet, to see the look of joy on her face when we say, we've got them. So I think the joy in our work is giving back some power and control at that time.
She's a huge inspiration. But the first time I met Wendy was in 2003, right after Cassandra Doe, who was a transgendered sex worker, was murdered.
That voice, Wendy Babcock. She's a prostitute. She worked closely with Detective Wendy Lever, helping her investigative team win the trust of street workers.
Originally starting out a bad date line, and then a unit that would work with sex workers.
Many prostitutes are afraid of the uniformed officers who share their nighttime world.
A lot of sex workers were really like, well, why should we work with the cops? The cops haven't helped us for all these years, so we don't want to work with the cops. Well, if the police are beating sex workers, raping them, not taking the thing seriously, then we need to work with the police. If we need to close that gap, who else are we going to turn to if we've been physically or sexually assaulted?
There are stories they won't tell to an officer like Wendy Lever, but that they have told to Wendy Babcock.
I'm not sure how much that's changed, because I got a report about a week ago, so I'm not sure how much that has changed.
What was the report?
About an officer targeting women, telling them that if they don't provide him with sexual services, that he would arrest them.
How surprised are you to hear that?
Surprised? I'm not too sure if I'm surprised. I can't deny that it happens. I can't say it does happen. But the problems that we confront is that Wendy and the different agencies will get the information. And I understand fully why the victims won't come forward to us. But Wendy will tell you, I always have the same mantra, just let us know who it is. Because the police service will not tolerate that. So I'm hoping, as the years go by, that we as a police service will develop enough trust with the agency that if that does happen, they will say, yeah, we will call the police because we know we will be believed. So am I surprised? No, I'm not surprised. Would I like to change it? Absolutely. Would we do something about it? Immediately. But we do understand why we don't get the information.
But to Wendy Lever, it's clear, any assault against a prostitute, whoever it comes from, plays out before a backdrop of society's disregard and unease.
I don't think attitudes in general have changed in relation to sex workers. No, I don't think so. I think that as a society, we don't take their work seriously. You know, keep it behind doors, okay? Like, I don't care where they go as long as they're not next door to me and they don't impact on my community. Their occupation deserves the same protection as any other occupation. We have to change our attitude, or we are going to end up with the Picton situation in Toronto.
For two decades in Vancouver, 61 women, maybe more, went missing before an investigation was launched. Wendy's small team here in Toronto, working far from the public spotlight and news headlines, may be the best reason yet that the Picton situation won't be repeated here. For CBC Radio, I'm Mary Weens in Toronto.
I'm Andy Berry, and this is our weekly podcast, Toronto This Week. Now here's Matt Galloway with a highlight from this week's Here and Now.
This morning, the Toronto District School Board announced that it's forming a partnership with real estate developer Tridel. The deal is this. Tridel will develop a multi-unit condominium on land that it bought from the TDSB. The board will take that money to rebuild North Toronto Collegiate Institute. A condo will share the site with the school, and according to board officials, this is all great news. To find out why, we're joined by Josh Matlow. He's the area's trustee. He's been involved in making this agreement happen. He's on the line with me now. Josh, hello.
Hi, Matt.
The arrangement is, as I essentially said, that the TDSB is going to sell Tridel this land and then take that money and rebuild North Toronto?
That's right. Yeah, you know, for several years, North Toronto was built at the turn of the previous century, and for several years, it's been crumbling. And I remember 4 years ago, visiting the school, and I had students come to me and point out bits and pieces of wall or ceiling that had come apart, various liquids dripping from one bathroom to another, heat in one room, cold in another. it's in a state of disrepair. And many of us fear as well that if we didn't take action now, within 20 years, there would be no North Toronto Collegiate because of, A, the state of disrepair, B, 80% of the student body comes from out of district, and C, it's sitting on a very valuable plot of land. And I expect that the TDSB would have eventually sold off the entire plot, and then you'd see a whole row of high-rise condominium towers, no school, and no community input or participation in the process.
And the TDSB simply didn't have the money to do these repairs.
Well, yeah, it's a very difficult reality for us. Most people know that there's a dearth of funding in the TDSB. Things have gotten a lot better over the past few years, but we still have a roughly $1 billion backlog in our facilities needs. And I think if you visit the average school, I mean, they're safe, they're great schools, but they're in need of better repair. And with North Toronto, this was an example of, I think, the worst of the worst. The school itself is remarkable. It's got a great reputation. We have you know, famous alumni. The kids love the school, but they merit a building that actually reflects, you know, how great they are.
This is going to be a very unusual arrangement. Where's the condo going to be located in relation to the school?
Well, there's going to be two condo buildings. One which is going to be 24 stories, another which is going to be 27 stories, and they're going to be adjacent to the building. They're not going to be actually on the building, but adjacent to it. Mm. And, you know, up until now, not only has the building been in disrepair, but also they've had a football field that they've hardly been able to use. It's considered a muddy pit. And the football team has actually had to play their home games at their friendly rival school, Northern Secondary School, which is up the street. So there's going to be a new a green field for the kids. It's going to be a state-of-the-art modern facility that's going to be actually the most environmentally friendly building that we've ever built in the TDSB. And, of course, my hope is that it'll be there for many years to come. So, you know, I once heard the term poverty breeds creativity. And I think this is an example of what you do when, it would be great to have tons of money to play with, but if you don't have that reality, you can't just whine about, we can't do things. You've got to be creative and figure out a way to do it, and this is what we've done.
Some people probably are whining, saying that the TDSB doesn't really, it's not really responsible for the TDSB to be involved in the business of real estate, that the business should be education.
Absolutely. Our business is education. But the TDSB, because of the nature of the business of education, is one of the largest landholders in the city. We have, I think, just under 600 properties across the city and just outside of the city. We have 97 of those, mind you, are closed or vacant sites, which we need to do something with as well. And we created recently an entity called the Toronto Lands Corporation, which is going to help us out. These are experts from development, architecture, design, et cetera.
David Crombie and more, yes.
David Crombie is going to be chairing that. Because, exactly, we're not experts in real estate. We're in the education business. But at the end of the day, we're going to be on far more solid ground to be able to negotiate with the province issues with the funding formula, benchmarks that I believe are frankly out of whack with reality, if we manage our assets well.
But as you said, the board has a lot of land. So is this sort of the way of the future? The board does not have a lot of money. A lot of schools need upkeep. Will it be looking to the private sector to finance these sort of capital projects if this is successful?
I believe it will. The process that we undertook here was incredibly successful because we made a partnership with Tridel, but we also made a partnership with the local residents. And in fact, the very ratepayers associations, which normally object to the impact of new high-rise development in their neighborhood, and we all know that Yonge and Eglinton is a hot spot for it, they're the very people who are championing this project because they were brought into the process from step one. And we actually ended up signing a memorandum of understanding where local residents, the community, restricted the height and density of the building. Mm. They participated in the interview and the design process. And at the end of the day, we're going to do what was unimaginable 4 or 5 years ago, which is actually have a new modern facility there that we couldn't have had if we hadn't struck this deal.
Josh Matlow,
I think it's going to be the future, yes.
Well, we'll leave it there. It is a very interesting, as you said, poverty breeds creativity. It's a really interesting solution. I'm not sure that everybody will be on side with this, but we'll ask to hear from listeners on it. Thanks so much.
I look forward to hearing them. Thank you.
Josh Matlow, school board trustee with the TDSB. What do you make of this solution? Again, some people would say that the TDSB has no business being in the business of real estate, that it should focus on its education. Do you worry that this could lead to negative precedents down the road? Or is this simply the way of the future? And if the TDSB doesn't have the money to complete the renovations, then it has to look to the people who do, those people being the private sector. 416-205-2700, the number of the telephone machine. 416-205-2700. 20 minutes after 3.
That was Matt Galloway, host of Here and Now, heard weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on CBC Radio 1, 99.1 in Toronto. And that will do it for our weekly podcast, Toronto This Week. You can hear all our shows live on CBC Radio 1 if you're in Toronto. That's on 99.1 and live on the web at cbc.ca/Toronto. And don't forget, much of our network programming is also now available via podcast. You'll find that at cbc.ca/podcast. We're also looking for some feedback on our podcast, and you can email us at metromorning@toronto.cbc.ca. I'm Andy Berry, the host of Metro Morning. We're heard weekday mornings from 6 to 8:30 on CBC Radio 1, 99.1 in Toronto. For all of us here at CBC Radio in Toronto, have a good week. We'll have another podcast for you next weekend.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.